KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm John Horn, sitting in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Evan Glodell, the writer, director, star, and engineer of the indie movie Bellflower. Plus, we travel to the Sarajevo Film Festival. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my LA Times colleague, Rebecca Keegan. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, John.
In the next week or so, the Venice Film Festival, the Telluride Film Festival, the Toronto International Film Festival will all start. It sounds like a lot of work, but taken together, these are probably three of the most important festivals for Hollywood. I would argue more important than Sundance and Cannes.
Yeah, this is the time of year when the studios and the independent film distributors and the publicists are all teeing up their movies that we'll be talking about going all the way up until the Academy Awards. These are the serious movies, movies people are very interested in, like Moneyball, which is a Brad Pitt film based on the Michael Lewis book. Ides of March, the political movie starring George Clooney. Also, Madonna's We, which she directed. A lot of interesting movies that we're going to be talking about for the next several months.
I'm not sure Madonna is going to be in the Oscar conversation, but one of the things that
we can hope, John.
We can only hope.
That she'll come to the parties.
I think one of the things that's really important is that something that a lot of movies that go to festivals are looking for is some sort of intangible momentum. Alexander Payne, who is the writer-director behind Sideways, has his first film in a number of years, The Descendants, another George Clooney film. So what they are hoping will happen, and the movie will be showing at the Telluride Film Festival, is that people will start talking about this movie in the kind of lofty terms that they never talk about summer movies, that conversation will carry through the end of the year and somehow attract kind of a zeitgeist around these films that makes them must-see movies.
Right. And then there's also some interesting other side films that may not be awards movies, but that are going to these festivals. For instance, there are a number of rock documentaries going to Toronto. There's a U2 documentary directed by Davis Guggenheim, the Waiting for Superman and An Inconvenient Truth director. There's a Pearl Jam documentary by Cameron Crowe, docs about Comic-Con and hockey from high-profile directors. So it's an interesting mix of stuff.
And I think it's safe to say that come next year, one movie that will not be at any festival is Ouija, or Ouija board, depending on how you pronounce it, which Universal has decided to put on its game shelf and never play.
That's right. I mean, Universal made this deal with the toy maker Hasbro to make movies out of a number of their toys. And they are canceling some of these films at great expense. For Ouija, they are eating a $5 million kill fee that they owe Hasbro. Now that Universal has passed on the Ouija movie, Hasbro is free to take that project to other studios.
And it's the third Hasbro movie that Universal has shut down. They were developing Clue with Gore Verbinski as the director and Monopoly with Ridley Scott as the director. Now, I have to say, you know, this is kind of all Transformers related a little bit. Hollywood is looking for brands that they can manipulate and exploit, but none of these games have stories. I mean, especially Ouija board, where you're just kind of pushing something around, or at least the spirits are pushing the thing around. You know, Clue, is Colonel Mustard a character in this?
With the candlestick in the library. I think Clue, I am disappointed about the Clue movie. But yeah, I mean, they're all trying to capitalize on the same idea that Transformers did, which is you take this beloved intellectual property, or IP as they call it, and you turn it into a billion-dollar franchise. And Universal is pushing forward with their Battleship movie based on that Hasbro game.
Yeah, you've I suck my battleship, and I hope that it's the $200 million movie that's coming out next summer that I think we hope does not sink Universal Studios. Meanwhile, two of Hollywood's more prominent independent studios, Legendary and Relativity, have announced deals in the last couple of weeks to make movies in China. Now, this is an attempt to get around the country's very tough import quota, which limits the number of movies that are non-Chinese that can be shown in that country's theaters.
That's right. China only allows 20 non-Chinese movies to be exhibited there, where the producer gets a share of the box office returns. And these Chinese co-productions potentially means big money for Hollywood because China is, by the end of the decade, going to be the largest film market in the world.
And the question is it a deal with the devil? Because when you make a movie in China as a co-production, you have to pass Chinese censors. And I think a lot of American studios are going to go into China very hopeful about how they're going to tap this market. And they're going to run into Chinese censors who are not going to be interested in seeing them tell their stories.
So I think it's a safe assumption that there will not be a Chinese co-production of, say, the Dalai Lama's biopic.
I think that's safe to say. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks, John.
Rebecca Keegan of the Los Angeles Times. Ever since 1989, when Steven Soderbergh sold Sex, Lies, and Videotape at the Sundance Film Festival, jump-started his career and put independent film on the map, generations of filmmakers have fantasized about following this same path into show business. So it's a little strange to meet a young filmmaker who didn't actually harbor that Sundance dream, and yet, despite himself, achieved it. Like countless Sundance movies, Evan Glodell's film Bellflower is a bit difficult to categorize. Bellflower is a romance, revenge, apocalypse thriller that's also sort of a buddy movie. In addition to writing and directing the film, Glodell plays a sweet, aimless guy who, with his best friend, has a penchant for tinkering and a childlike fascination with the Australian apocalyptic thriller Road Warrior. In this scene, the two guys test out a homemade flamethrower that they use with nothing but sunglasses for protection.
Ready? Pilot is lit.
Okay.
All right.
All right, here we go. Wait, what if it blows up or something?
Then we're gonna be on fire.
Okay. Should we have safety stuff?
Oh, dude, I totally forgot. Here you go, Commander.
Oh, perfect. I feel much better now. All right, here goes.
Bellflower is a real do-it-yourself indie. Glodell and his buddies actually built that flamethrower and the souped-up ride in the film known as the Medusa Car. The cast and crew are made up of his gang of friends that go by the name Coat Wolf. Their film was made in and around Ventura, California for $17,000 over 4 years. Glodell didn't go to film school or even take film classes. In fact, as a kid growing up in Wisconsin, he didn't even see Hollywood anywhere in his future.
I never wanted to be a filmmaker. I always thought I was going to be an engineer because I was always good at building stuff and fixing stuff the whole time I was growing up. So everybody's like, you should be an engineer. So I thought I was going to be an engineer. When I turned 18, I went to college for engineering, and I was there for about a week, and I was like, holy crap, I don't want to do this. I think they took us to, it was like intro to engineering class, and they had us meet a working engineer who was totally cool, but like meeting him in this working environment, and that's where I feel like he spent a good portion of his life, working in this like small working environment, and it freaked me out. And so as soon as I, for the first time ever, I didn't know what I, like had at least something to say on the surface of my mind, what I was going to do when I grew up or whatever, all of a sudden once that disintegrated, I instantly was like, I'm going to make movies. I'm going to move to LA and make movies, something I never even thought about before.
Glodell dropped out of college and made his way to Los Angeles. He had no connections and no plan. He decided the only way he was going to become a filmmaker was to make movies. So he bought a camcorder and started shooting. At first, it was just himself and his brother. But then he began to meet people, and his gang developed. At the same time, he became interested in optical technology and the latest in high-def cameras. He even convinced a company to give him a camera that was in the late stages of development. Glodell proceeded to hack that camera and the others the company ended up giving him to meet his own visual style. And with that, Glodell and his friends began work on Bellflower. Here he tells the business producer Darby Maloney how they went about funding their first feature.
So how do you pay for all this stuff? I mean, I read that Bellflower cost $17,000.
Yes.
Is that...
The $17,000 number is made up because the budget was really zero. The budget was zero. I had I think about $3,000 saved up beforehand, and then someone gave us $3,000, And then we did one job. We worked as a team. We stopped shooting and went and shot another movie in the middle of our movie because we ran out of money. And just by chance, someone asked us to shoot this low-budget horror film for 10 days. So we took our crew. In the middle of our shooting, we were like, wait, can we do this? We have to do this. And we just stopped, went over there for 10 days, shot like crazy, and then came back and kept shooting our movie. And the rest of the money is just literally the actors and the crew, just everybody paying their own way to get there. And whoever had any extra money, it was like $100 here and there. Because all the main group people that worked on it, they owned, we all collectively owned the movie.
Was that like legally agreed upon
ahead
of time?
Yeah, we didn't really know what we were doing. We kind of had an idea. We'd heard there's a point system and we had 100 points and we kind of had, all right, we got 100 points. Everybody that's working on this for this amount of time gets this many. And someone's like, oh, we're out of money. So-and-so's like, I got $500. Like, oh, another point. Cool. And in the end, it worked out pretty even. We got lucky. Especially since it was slowly done over time. It could have like been weighted way wrong at some point.
So this took 4 years to actually make the film from when you decided pre-production to send
it? Yeah, a lot of people say the number I keep hearing is 3 years, but 3 years means from the day we started shooting.
And over that time, you were having to pay for your life doing other things, I assume? I mean, what?
No, I became homeless. I was couch surfing, bouncing around. A bunch of the guys, we all did that. We were all crashing each other's places or wherever we could crash when we were shooting full time. And then once that ended, most people went back to their regular lives. One of my good friends let me basically take over their garage. I just like set up my editing computer in there and I stuck a mattress in the corner and that's where I spent over a year, I think. I feel like I'm lucky that I got to even do it like this because basically I was being supported by my friends.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it.
And these are my friends and they're also people who worked on the movie. It's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're
right, and they had a vested interest because they all had points.
Yeah, they're like, I will keep feeding you something while you live in that garage.
And what was the goal? Like once it was done, was Sundance always the goal? Or
I've never even thought about Sundance. I mean, I've heard of Sundance, but the goal was to make the movie good, hopefully. But the idea was to jumpstart our careers. And if we got lucky, it would get distribution. And I had different ideas of what that was early on before I think Netflix had fully taken over. I was like, if we get one copy on the shelf of Blockbuster, that would be the coolest thing. And then it came towards the end, right before we got to Sundance, we're like, if we just show up on Instant Queue on Netflix with no advertising and not a word said anywhere about it, like that would be awesome.
So how did you end up submitting to Sundance?
We got to the point where we thought it was done. We're like, this is done. And we were trying to show it around. We couldn't get anybody to even, no one seemed to have any interest whatsoever. So our friend, Mike Rousselet, who was at one of these screenings,
right,
and he, really liked the movie. So it was him that finally called because he heard that we kind of struck out. Like, we had a couple of these screenings, and we were talking to people and just had almost gotten a universally negative reaction from anybody we were trying to get something from, being like, this movie doesn't work. You're going to have to change this, and this. And that was pretty devastating. That was the first time I had, unwaveringly for... 4 years now, right? Almost 4 years, been just pushing. I'm like, I can't question what I'm doing or it's going to collapse. I'm just going to keep pushing and it's going to eventually work out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was those screenings and the people coming up and saying mean things afterwards that finally killed me. I went back to my friend's house and I just slept on the couch for I think almost a month. I got to, really depressed. And it was right at the beginning of that time period that Mike had heard that we weren't doing well. And he was like, Sundance Deadline's coming up. You need to submit it. I said, okay. And I didn't do it like I always do. And then he called again. 2 weeks later or something, it's like, today is the last day of the extended late deadline. You have to upload your movie. This may be the thing that starts something happening. I mean, I said, okay, again, but he's like, no, seriously, you have to do this. I'm not going to get on the phone with you unless you promise me you're going to do it. And I was like, fine.
If you're just joining us, I'm John Horn, sitting in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business. We're talking with filmmaker Evan Glodell, the director, writer, and star of the indie film Bellflower, which is now in theaters. Glodell had nearly given up on the film and his own career when, at the last minute, a friend pushed him to submit Bellflower to the Sundance Film Festival, assuming Glodell could scrape together the $100 submission fee.
I had called up an old employer and been like, do you have any work for me? Because I need some money. It was the first time I'd actually looked for a job since this whole thing started. And they didn't, but they're like, we have a fence on our property that needs to be fixed. So I went up there and they're like, we can pay you to do that. So I spent a week, I fixed their fence, and they gave me $400 or something. And I was going to take the $400 and I was going to buy a motorcycle because I found this motorcycle for $300 that I thought I could fix for free and then I was going to ride out of town. I was like, I can't take this anymore. I've literally been in the same spot for years just struggling on this movie. Like I hadn't even left town. Like I've just been here dying. And I was like, I'm going to get this motorcycle and I'm going to go visit some friends and I'm sure I can even panhandle gas money because it's a motorcycle. It doesn't take much gas. And I literally got that check and that was when Mike called me the second time. It was like, today's the day. And I had the money and I was like, if I put that $100, I'm not going to be able to get my motorcycle. And then I finally was sitting there and I remember I had that moment where I was like, my life has been in the toilet money that I need to pay the DMV, to pay off like any tickets or things that have come up, like tax, whatever it is, I all put it in the movie. I don't care. Like my life is just steadily like just like disintegrating. Like I'm in a ton of debt. And then I had this money that I was going to finally buy something fun with, you know, to like go. And Mike called and I'm like, this is pretty weird timing. And he's calling me the one time I've got money in my hand. The first time there was money in my hand that I wasn't going to put back in the movie. And he was like, dude, you got to submit. And then I was like, oh, this is what I've done this far. I can't stop now. And I just did it.
Wow.
So it seemed like a big moment to me. I'm like,
it's... No, it's a huge moment. So what was it like when you got to Sundance? First of all, how'd you get the money to go to Sundance?
And... Now that we had gotten into Sundance, we were able to borrow money because it was more likely. So people were helping us. We borrowed some money to get us all out there and to get our festival licenses for our music.
Mm-hmm.
It was, for me, it was very stressful. Like, there's a reason that that's, like, the most important film festival, because everybody there, it feels like Christmas every day or something, because everybody's, like, always saying congratulations to everybody, and, like, it's this big deal, and there's, like, a whole team of people to handle each one of the filmmakers, and, like, everybody's, like, all excited. So, but me, I was just, like, a crazy person. I was, like, so stressed out, I didn't want anything to go wrong, because it was, like, the one time we'd been given a chance.
And did you have any representation there with you?
We did, yes. And that's the other thing. I mean, once we got in, all of a sudden... people started coming to us. Our email, I forget what email it was. We had an email set up with our website or something that had just like an anonymous contact. And that was just filling up like daily with just like sales agents and different people that wanted to meet with us and producers and like just on speculation. They're like, I think it must have been interesting to people because we're not even like really like on IMDb or anything. Like there was no information. No one knew who any of us were. Right. So we had CAA representing our movie as our sales agent by the time we got to Sundance, which was awesome.
Did they give you an idea of what figure you could expect?
They really were trying to curb our expectations.
Right.
They were basically like, you know, everybody's really unusually excited about your movie, especially the situation you're in, and that's why we're even here. We're not expecting to make money off this. You know, I can't remember what the exact numbers were, but it wasn't much. They were like, don't get excited about what it's going to be.
It was well beyond 17,000, I assume.
Yes, substantially. Yeah. And always the wildest dream we had, like I said, you were asking this earlier, but when we were joking around, we're like, what if we got a theatrical release in like New York and LA? Because I know that some indie movies get that, just those two cities. And so the first offer that came in from Oscilloscope was guaranteeing at least 15 cities theatrically.
So how has your life changed? I mean, you said that since Sundance, it's been nonstop. Do you have a place to live now? Are you still couch hopping?
It looks like I'm at the very tail end, probably like this next like week or two of couch surfing. But it's because with all contracts and everything, it takes a long time for money to finally come in. So our advance has finally been coming in. Like the first check came in like 3 days ago.
And are you getting meetings? Are people pitching you things, offers? Yeah. Like what? How is your sort of standing in the business changed?
All of that stuff is going on. There's, you know, I'm right at the beginning of that because I've still been busy with the movie. And so I think that there's a lot of meetings I'm going to be having in the next couple weeks, months.
Mm-hmm.
But already there's been a huge number of people who've expressed producing and helping in various ways, whatever our next project is. So that was kind of the dream in the beginning. That was to get paid to make the next one.
Do you feel any kind of pressure?
You mean in what?
You know, to sort of live up to, I mean, you know, some of the writing about you is like, this is the guy to watch, you know, the next indie.
I do feel a little bit, but not too much. I mean, like about the next project.
Yeah. And even now to sort of be, you know, in the limelight.
Yes,
now.
I do. The pressure, I finally think something clicked and I got over this. But I've actually felt an unbelievable amount of pressure because I kind of like really like threw my life in the trash to do this. And for a really long time, even to the point where I didn't have any clothes left, you know, like and so like I've been slowly coming out of this like kind of dark place I've been in where I've just been like working like crazy person. Be like, I hope this movie makes something happen. I hope this makes something happen. And when all this stuff started happening, like everybody from my life, and they're all calling me and like, Evan, oh my God, you must be so excited. And I'm like actually at home kind of depressed, you know, like stressed up and like, okay, what do I do next? You know, like that was a trip. But I think about like maybe 2 months ago, finally something clicked and I was like, wait a minute, everything is awesome. Like everything is like, it's like beginning steadily better every day.
Well, Evan Glodell, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
To see a video of Evan Glodell with his Medusa car and for a link to where Bellflower is playing, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also comment about our show. Coming up after a short break, we go to the Sarajevo Film Festival. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com. This is The Business, and I'm John Horn, sitting in for Kim Masters. As we mentioned in the banter, over the next few weeks, the film industry will turn its attention to the Venice, Telluride, and Toronto film festivals. But last month in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia in the former Yugoslavia, there was a film festival of a different sort, one that didn't attract the kind of attention in the global press that these others do. Still, the Sarajevo Festival plays an increasingly important role in that region's film industry. Now in its 17th year, the festival was precipitated by the four-year siege that ravaged the city. That brutal conflict left at least 100,000 people dead and more than 2.2 million displaced, including our contributor, Valida Carroll. Carroll left her country just prior to the wars breaking out and has been an expatriate on three continents since then. Her adopted home is Los Angeles, where she's a KCRW DJ, and she does regular sets on the LA party circuit. But last month, she made her annual pilgrimage back to her homeland for the Sarajevo Film Festival.
Every summer, I leave the LA madness and fly 14 hours back to Bosnia for the Sarajevo Film Festival. I go to DJ a few parties, but also to reconnect with family and friends who, like me, return to the city for this event each year. There's something about going back to Sarajevo during the film festival. That's when the city really comes alive. The streets, restaurants, and sidewalk cafes are filled with expats, tourists, media, and film people, all here for this 9-day event. But it wasn't always like this. Back in 1993, as Sarajevo was under constant shelling and sniper fire, if people wanted to watch films, they turned to a collective of artists and filmmakers called the Obala Art Center. That group tried to keep cinema and culture alive during the war, and it was headed by Mirsad Purivatra, who is today the director of the Sarajevo Film Festival.
Even before the war, we used to have retrospectives of Tarkovsky, Fassbinder, Wenders, and we continued with this during the war. There was this simple need to have these types of programs and to be in the company of world artists and their work.
But because so many movie theaters were bombed out, they had to create a makeshift movie theater on the stage of the Academy for Performing Arts. Elmat Tataragic is another founding member of the festival and is now its chief program director.
People would come in and there were no tickets. The entrance was one cigarette or two cigarettes just for the people working at the cinema.
The following year, in 1994, they held a review of movies from the Locarno Film Festival in Switzerland and snuck three Swiss cultural ambassadors into Sarajevo for the event. Since the city was still under siege, they entered the only way they could, through the tunnel. Built during the war underneath the runway of the Sarajevo airport, the tunnel connected the city to the world outside. Again, here's Elmat Tataragic.
So the three of them came to Sarajevo under siege, and they stayed. They were supposed to stay just for the program, but then they couldn't return back home, so they were forced to stay here. It was longer than they have planned.
But these outsiders bonded with the Bosnian artists, and a collaboration developed. In particular, Marco Miller, the director of the Locarno Film Festival in Switzerland, was encouraging.
We asked him in one of the meetings, well, does it make any sense to make a film festival? You know, we are in a war, we don't know when the war will end. And he said, wow, it would be great, I would support you, absolutely.
So Elma and the rest planned to turn their film programs into a full-fledged festival by the summer of 1995. But that turned out to be one of the most violent periods of the war. There was a genocide of 8,000 men and boys in Srebrenica, about an hour outside of the city. Still, the artists were determined to hold the film festival. And in late October, they did.
And it was a crazy, really crazy little event. We had about 40 films, but we had very interesting guests. We had Alfonso Cuarón here with his film The Little Princess. He came also through the tunnel and through all these mountains to just spend some time. When he showed the film The Little Princess, he was showing it to kids who were 6, 7. And for these kids who were growing up in a war, it was the first time they went to cinema.
During that first festival, the war continued and people had to literally dodge bullets to get to the films. But it was a bona fide international film festival, screening movies from 15 countries, including Iranian director Jafar Panahi's film The White Balloon and Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction.
We got into this thing with the best intentions, really.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
By late 1995, the war was finally over. So the following summer, the Sarajevo Film Festival took on a whole other meaning. Again, program director Elmat Tataragic.
It was the end of the war, so we were thinking how to celebrate this new freedom coming to the city after so many years. So we decided to make the open-air cinema for 2,500 people, which was amazing because for the first time, people could gather outside, sit outside, watch a film and not be afraid of a shell or a sniper or a bomb.
These are not sounds of the city under siege. It's the fireworks from the opening gala for this year's festival. I'm navigating through a sea of roughly 500 guests at this exclusive late-night party held at the mayor's residence. Over the last 17 years, the festival has grown tremendously. This year, over 200 films screened, and there were parties every night lasting until the wee hours of the morning.
I think it's unlike anything else in terms of festivals around the world.
That's Alma Fedovic, an old friend of mine who goes to the festival each year.
So from year to another year, it's growing and growing and growing.
The festival attracts some of the leading names in the world of cinema. Past guests include John Malkovich, Michael Moore, Juliette Binoche, and Morgan Freeman. This year's coveted Heart of Sarajevo Honorary Award was given to Angelina Jolie, both for her work as an UN Ambassador of Goodwill, who calls attention to the plight of Bosnian refugees, and also for her upcoming directorial debut, In the Land of Blood and Honey, a feature film set in wartime Bosnia, which opens in theaters later this year.
I'm so happy to be in this remarkable city, in this beautiful country. And
German filmmaker Wim Wenders was also at the festival this year showing his latest film, a 3D musical documentary, Pina.
What brings you to Sarajevo?
The fact that I've promised to come for an eternity and it never worked out. And I sent some of my movies here, but I never made it myself. And I'm happy I could come here with Pina. It was my very first time. It still is my first time, but not my last time.
During the Sarajevo Film Festival, while parties and premieres are happening, there's also a parallel event taking place, a film market.
Which serves as a platform for regional filmmakers, their new projects, where they can actually meet financiers, European film funds, European producers. This is why people are coming here.
The Sarajevo Film Festival has had a tremendous effect on the growth of the film business in the region. Bosnian films have won major awards, including an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film in 2001 and, at the 2006 Berlin Film Festival, The Golden Bear. So naturally, film festival director Mirsad Purivatra considers the possibility of foreign productions choosing to work in Bosnia.
I think it's all up to us. If we develop favorable conditions for filming, and if the crews are well trained, the tax breaks in order, of course, people will come to Bosnia and this region to shoot films.
I asked festival programmer Elma Tataragic if she thinks there will be increased collaborations between Hollywood studios and our regional film industry.
European cinema is European cinema, and Bosnian cinema is much closer to European cinema than to Hollywood. But yeah, absolutely, why not? Everything's possible.
For the business, I'm Valida Carroll in Sarajevo.
You can see photos of the festival and of the tunnel at our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. We had help this week from Jenny Rattlett. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can stream or podcast the show. You can listen to us on demand on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry with our KCRW apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.